You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, July 26, 2017, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Kara Santa Maria.
Howdy.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Good evening, folks.
Welcome back, guys. Actually, been several weeks since we recorded the show between Nexus and everything.
That's true.
That's right. It's been a while.
So, as we mentioned briefly on our short episode last week, the Novella brothers' father died. He passed away actually exactly 1 week ago. It was on the day we were supposed to record the last episode. So, we've been dealing with that for the past week, which, you know, totally sucks. I want to say out of the gate, you know, we had a lot of sympathy emails from a lot of our listeners, not only friends and family, of course, but just a lot of people just listening to the show. So for everybody who took the time to send us your condolences, you know, thank you. We really did help. It does mean a lot, you know, when people pull together in times like that. So thank you very much.
We want to talk about our dad because of how crucial he was to inspiring us to actually get to this podcast and to do this podcast. So first of all, you know, this was not a tragedy. My dad was 86. He lived an amazingly full life. I could spend an hour describing things to everyone about him. But in short, my dad was the absolute most generous human being I've ever met in my life. He did more. He helped hundreds, if not thousands of people in his life by, you know, either sharing money, giving them things, putting the time and attention to help them with problems that they were having or whatever. I mean, this was the overwhelming common theme of everyone that came to his wake. Not that I didn't already know. Everybody that knew my dad knew he was generous, but
yeah, but there's a ton of stuff we didn't know about. Like people came out of the woodwork and said, oh, your father, you know, bought me a car so I can get to work when I had nothing, or, you know what I mean? Like just there was people or families or whatever in need. He would just give them what they needed, you know, to get on with their life. Just constantly was doing that and never talked about it.
That's incredible.
You know, it was just doing it in the background.
Yeah, I think that's the part that is pretty amazing, like the density of all of that. You know, my dad also had a phenomenally fun sense of humor and one of those laughs that, you know, just makes you smile just from hearing him laugh. But to get back to my comment, my dad gave all of us, all of his kids, a love for learning and science. I mean, my mom was definitely a part of that, not to take any credit away from her at all. But my dad was like the science and science fiction influencer for us. That absolutely was the gateway to all of us becoming complete fans of science and you know, science fiction, I think, you know, goes hand in hand with a love for science for a lot of people, if not everyone.
Absolutely, Jay. I mean, I can remember him taking us to see science fiction movies, watching Star Trek with him, growing up, and talking about things like that over the dinner table and with him. That he was such a big push for us. I think we would have been drawn naturally to those types of things anyway, but he definitely started us on that path. And I mean, how huge is that?
Oh, without a doubt.
Science fiction.
It's not hyperbole. It's actually fair to say that the intellectual core of this show started with discussions that we would have around the dinner table or in the family room or whatever. I mean, topics would come up, things like, oh, did aliens ever visit the planet, and or just how do volcanoes work, whatever, just weird stuff. Dad would say, oh, I just saw this documentary about something, you know, in history. He loved history as well as science and all that. And then we would have a 2-hour discussion about it. So just the sheer love of not only learning, but teaching and thinking about interesting things. Again, the lines between science and science fiction were blurred when we were younger, but it was all just endlessly fascinating. And that created the culture really in our family out of which this show developed. I mean, I think it's fair to say without that, you know, the SG wouldn't even exist.
Yeah, that conversation, those conversations were just a daily occurrence in our house growing up. And it wasn't, you know, like around dinner, but that was a focal point. But also hearing all of my childhood friends that I saw over the past week, you know, comment about how the house was open and they became family members, and they were involved in those conversations. I mean, one of our friends, Mike King, Bob, he would say to us, even you know, as recently as 10 years ago, he would say, going to the movies with you guys is great just for the car ride home because you guys would dissect every nuance of the movie. I mean, that was my dad.
Yep.
That was my dad. I mean, he started those conversations. He infused us with that type of thinking. He made those well-worn pathways in our minds. So, Dad, thank you. More than I could ever live up to who you were and try to follow the path that you took and the goodness that you provided to this world. You know, thank you for giving me a love for science, because I think I wouldn't have fully become who I am today if my dad didn't give that to me. I mean, could you imagine not being a critical thinker and not being a skeptic? And then I so rarely ever talk about like my impression of the influence of this show on reality, because I don't like to blow a horn that doesn't need to be blown. But I do know how many people listen to this show, and I do communicate with a lot of people that listen to this show. And my dad has had a massive impact on the world through us, from what he gave us. And I think that is a massive legacy for him as well.
Yeah, just today I was reading an email from somebody from New Zealand who essentially became a molecular microbiologist because of our show, is what he said in the email. We see emails like that occasionally. That's just, they're amazing. It really makes my entire day when I see those. And yeah, and I like how you put that, Jay. You know, in a way, Dad caused that by raising us the way he did and making us prioritize and love the things that we love. He's flowing through us.
Yeah.
And Jay, you brought up another aspect of Dad's personality that, again, was so reinforced by all the people that showed up, you know, at the wake and the funeral and just talking with us over the last week, is that, you know, when you came into our home, you were part of the family, right? Yeah. That, again, right. It just became part of the culture of the Novella family. And it was probably more often than not, we did have other people living with us in the house, you know?
Yeah.
A friend of my sister's had a bad situation with her family life. She moved in for 8 months while she needed a place to stay. You mentioned, you know, Mike King stayed with us for a while, and other people as well. It was always open. And even if you weren't, you know, didn't need a place to live, just while you were visiting, like, he would tell our friends, don't knock, just come in, you know, your family. We would all, and I think, you know, I'd like to think that that culture extends to the podcast as well. And I think that we get a lot of feedback to indicate that we sort of behave like we're just, everything is just sort of an extension of those sort of friendly or familial feelings. And again, that legacy goes back to our father.
Yeah, I can attest to that. And I think Evan obviously has a longer history with you guys, and I'm sure feels the same way, that I immediately, when I got to join with you guys, felt like your little sister. I mean, I think that you guys made me feel incredibly welcome and like a part of the family, you know, just from day one.
You know, Joe Sr. had such respect for for all his children, especially, you know, the three of you guys, in that when you came into the house and you met Joe for the first time and he did treat you like one of the family, I think that was a sign of respect for you guys, that you guys would only sort of bring quality people in because of what you've learned from your parents. Mm-hmm. And that he trusted you guys very much to make good judgments about people. Yeah. And I think that speaks volumes.
Yeah, I think so too, Ev. I mean, I think, you know, my dad saw what we became and loved it and reveled in it. You know, I mean, he loved talking to us about our adventures and what we were doing with our lives. And the podcast is always, it's a huge thing in all of our lives. I mean, we talk about it all the time. We spend a lot of time on this podcast, and it's not just the thing we record once a week. We live it every day for us. And so my dad was in on the whole thing. I mean, we had him on our 24-hour show. You know, we had to bring him down and get his face on air so people can see him and get a taste of, you know, just how funny and awesome he was. I mean, my dad was the guy that I couldn't wait to introduce people to, because I knew that he would do that, right? I knew he'd sit them down at the kitchen table, and as he's chewing on a meatball, would win their hearts over, because he just was, you know, this maximal, genuine, loving, funny as hell, like super sharp. My dad's memory.
Oh, yeah.
My dad's memory was, it blows my mind how my dad had some type of visual-based memory where he could close his eyes and see information. Like, my dad built houses. He was a custom home builder. And at his peak, he had about 17 houses going at once. At once. And
which is pretty much unheard of. I mean, that just doesn't happen.
But this is a guy that had it in his head. You know, it's like if I had to do that level of work, I mean, I think about what I do in my job. My dad was running, you know, custom building 17 houses at the same exact time. And he could close his eyes and know exactly which of his subcontractors was working in which house and at what stage they were in and exactly what, you know, marble countertop was going into which one of those houses. And I mean, he had it all in his mind. And I feel like I owe it to my dad to say on the show that first, love your family, cherish every freaking moment you have because you just don't know. Like my dad went out like a switch; he had a heart failure and he dropped dead in my house. You know, you can't predict when you're going to lose people. So please, you know, keep that in mind as you spend time with the people that you love, and make more quality time. Number one, and number two, be generous. Change the world by being generous. Show, you know, do something for someone that you don't know, not just the people that you do know. Just become a more generous person to make the world a better place.
It was inspiring, like, you know, just talking to so many people over the past week about him and what he meant to them and what he did. You realize that is your legacy, right? You think about all the things that you could possibly do, but the thing that people really remember and care about the most is that you were nice to them. You know what I mean? That you cared about them.
They treated him with respect, definitely.
Yeah. Yep. Oh, he treated everybody with dignity and respect. And again, he also, I think, in a lot of ways, embodied what I've tried to promote, which is like, don't take shit personally. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
If he knew somebody personally, it didn't matter what their, you know, politics were, what their belief system was or anything. You know, just the diversity of people that were part of this extended family of ours was incredible. Yep. And right. So he, you know what I mean? It's like he would always be able to separate that out, you know?
Yep, that is true.
I had to remind him about that, like when he started talking about in the abstract. I think a lot of people do, you know? Mm-hmm. It's like, oh yeah, you know, this group of people in the abstract or whatever are negative. Or I'm like, yeah, but except for everyone that you actually personally know, right? You know, that's, but so many people do that.
Yeah, to know that he made it that far and lived his life on his terms is another amazing thing to think about that kind of takes some of my pain away. And I have been preparing because I thought that we were going to lose my dad 20 years ago. The guy had open heart surgery. The guy had kidney cancer. The guy had both his knees replaced. You know, he had major surgeries that any little thing goes wrong, a blood clot to the brain, anything, we could have lost him. I was on some level prepared, of course, but when the thing finally happens, I mean, then, you know, even though you are prepared, it's still horrible, but I'm not sad in the way of a normal loss would be if it were someone younger or it was more tragic. It's just the way that life goes.
Yeah, but it's still sad. So no matter how prepared you are, no matter how, you know, yeah, he definitely had a good run, and there's a lot of things to be grateful for. He was quick. He had a decent quality of life towards the end. The timing probably was good, you know, because his quality of life was probably going to slip to an unacceptable level before too long. So there's a lot to be grateful for, but none of that really takes the sting out of the fact that our father died and he's gone, you know.
Of course,
so
yeah.
Just the way it is, it's just going to suck. Yeah, but we do focus on the good stuff as much as possible to help get you through it.
My last word on this whole thing is that to me, family and friends and being a good person is one of the reasons to be alive. If you're ever as an atheist or an agnostic who's having trouble with meaning, you know, and it's, you know, this will challenge your like, hey, why are we alive? What's the point if we die? And if you believe that this is the end, that this life is the only life we have, you know, I think I kind of always looked at life like the crest of a wave, that all the people that come before us are the water beneath the crest of the wave. And when you're alive, you are living in that crest. And one day you will become that support for the next generation. And I think being a good person and loving people and being a reliable person for your family that is there as a foundation for other people and putting other people first and trying to obtain some type of selfless kind of love in your life is a reason to be alive. And I learned that from my dad.
Yeah. You make your own meaning, you know, I absolutely agree with that. You could find meaning on your own terms, you know, the fact that we, you know, we don't believe in the supernatural doesn't really take away the fact that we're human beings. There's a lot of meaning to our existence, meaning that we, what we make for it. And, you know, it could be really, really profound. I think the other thing that I think my father taught all of us is how extraordinary an ordinary life can be. You know what I mean? Like he wasn't a superhero, wasn't a rock star, wasn't a celebrity or famous or anything. He was just a, you know, an average family man, but he made that into an extremely extraordinary thing. Mm-hmm. And you really, I mean, we knew it, but then you kind of forget it because it's somebody that's that close to you. You know what I mean? And then seeing the hundreds of people that show up at the wake, all with their own story about how Dad, you know, was so good to them and changed their lives, you know, really brought it home to us again, how, you know, just by being a good person day in and day out, how he had an extraordinary life, you know.
I love that. Yeah.
It's achievable for all of us, you know, that I think we sometimes can get lost in the idea that, oh, people are just the way that they are, and, you know, this person was born with intelligence, this other person was born with good looks and everything. But, you know, you ever get surprised by someone being like really nice, and it gives you pause.
Yeah.
Right? Because you go to New York City, I'm ordering a cup of coffee at Nexus 4 weeks ago, and I was shocked at how obnoxious the person was. Like, just this average 20-year-old somebody that couldn't even be nice, you know. And I'm like, I'm always trying to be nice and make a connection with every person I meet, you know. It's just, that's cooked into me. But my point is, it's just a choice you make in your head.
Yeah,
just a choice, right? You could just decide, I'm going to be really nice to people today and see how that goes, see how that feels for you.
Yeah, and really, like, the truth of the matter is, when you are in those final throes, those of us who have time to reflect on it, like, there is scientific evidence, like really good kind of qualitative studies, surveys of individuals who are dying, and when asked what brought them the most satisfaction, what mattered the most to them, they often say love and work. Those are the things that carried them through. They're the things that mattered the most. And very few people say, I wish I'd been mean to more people. Yeah, you know, right. I wish I'd screwed more people over.
I held more grudges.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, a lot of people really, when they look back at their life, those are the things they remember. The warm connections they had with people, the way they were able to open their hearts to people, and the satisfaction that they got from doing hard work and feeling accomplished afterward.
Having a purpose and having connections.
Absolutely.
Those are the
That's
two
it.
Things that matter the
That's
most.
What matters. Yeah. And it does not matter what religion you are. It does not matter what you believe in. Those are central to everybody.
And it's not even about money. Like, you know, because my dad was very generous with his money, but he was more generous with his time and with his consideration.
Sure.
So this episode is for Dad. But in a way, Dad is a huge part of the legacy of the whole SGU because, I mean, obviously three of his sons are on the show. And I think the best things that we bring to the show were definitely things that we got from him. All right, well, let's move on to some news items. Carrie, you're going to start us off by talking about the NFL and brain injury.
Yeah, I mean, this isn't really a new story, but there were some new findings recently. And those of you who read the New York Times, you might have come across this article. If not, I do recommend that you Google it because it's a really beautiful kind of interactive piece that they've posted online. So there's a lot of pictures and things you can post through. Basically, this was a write around of a study that was published in JAMA, the Journal of the American Medical Association, just yesterday, July 25th, 2017. And it's trending pretty heavily online right now, called Clinico-Pathological Evaluation of Chronic Traumatic Encephalopathy in Players of American Football. And so these were some authors at Boston University, one of the kind of preeminent places where CTE, or as I said, chronic traumatic encephalopathy, is covered or studied. They have a very big brain bank. Dr. Ann McKee is a neuropathologist who has been working there for quite some time, and she was involved in this research. And basically, the publication is just a broad survey of recent findings, where at BU, they looked at 202 brains of football players from every level. So all the way from, you know, a high school football player to a professional football player and anywhere in between. And they found that 87% of the 202 brains were found to have CTE. So it was a very high number, kind of in line with what I think most people are expecting now. But what is, I think, trending in the headlines is that of the 111 NFL players that were studied, 110 of them had CTE. So almost every single NFL player. Now, Dr. McKee does warn that obviously this was not a scientific experiment. This was not a blinded study. And there was a massive selection bias in looking at these brains because Boston University has been doing this for quite some time. Families of players and players themselves, when they start to exhibit symptoms or when they start to feel differently and worry that maybe they are experiencing CTE, which can only be diagnosed on autopsy, they'll often choose to have their brains donated. And so, you know, many of these brains were probably sent specifically to the brain bank simply because they thought they might already have CTE. So do bear that in mind. But that said, it's still a significantly higher number than would be expected in the regular population. And there's even a calculation in the article about the somewhere close to 1,300 former players that have died since the group began examining brains. And even if every single other brain of anybody in the NFL didn't have CTE, which is not likely at all, that would still be a 9% incidence rate. It would still be way higher than the general population. But the truth is, it's probably significantly higher than that. So again, 87% of the 202, 110 out of 111 NFL players, and they came from all different positions: linemen, running backs, defensive backs, linebackers, quarterbacks, wide receivers, tight ends, and they even had one place kicker and one punter who had pathological findings consistent with CTE. So let's maybe take a step back and talk about what CTE is, so that people who have not heard of this phenomenon can become familiar with it. Chronic traumatic encephalopathy, it really comes from, well, actually, it used to be called dementia pugilistica.
Pugilistica.
Yeah, dementia pugilistica. It used to be thought, you know, because we've known about CTE for some time, but we categorized it differently through the years. And we used to just think it happened to boxers. So DP, yeah, dementia pugilistica was associated with boxers. And then we started to see findings in American football players, rugby players, hockey players, even soccer players, or European football, if you want to call it that, wrestling, stunt, rodeo riding, and lots of other contact sports. And the thing is, it happens from frequent trauma, frequent repeated brain trauma, like concussions or even subconcussive forces. That doesn't mean your head has to crack into something. It can be a head in motion injury where your body quickly stops, but your head keeps moving inside of your brain. And it doesn't have to cause concussion. Now, don't worry if you had one concussion once in your life. There's no link between single concussive events and CTE. Nobody's been able to find one. But in athletes and other individuals who have repeated brain trauma, CTE does have some correlation with that. And it's very obvious on pathology. The brain looks really, really shrunken down. And they use a stain to look for tau proteins, and tau proteins are sort of the pathological marker of CTE. It is a tau pathology, just like Alzheimer's disease is a tau pathology, but they're able to see these tau proteins in a very specific pattern. And that pattern tends to be in areas that are really associated with the behavior that we've seen, especially in recent news stories about these football players. So we'll see that there's tau buildup in the frontal cortex. And we've talked about this a lot on the show, but the frontal cortex really has a lot to do with things like planning, with things like working memory, different types of executive functioning, reasoning. We also see that the insula and the amygdala are affected in CTE. And these are two areas that are really important in emotion and also aggression and anxiety. So a lot of times we'll see some correlation between individual players later in life who start to exhibit symptoms and they start to feel really aggressive. They may become violent. You might see some domestic abuse problems in the news as related to this condition. Also, problems with impulse control and just feeling like really anxious and upset. There's also a lot of times correlation with depressive symptoms. And as the disease advances, it can damage the mammillary bodies. So you start to see memory deficits and even signs of dementia. And there are, in a few small cases, some Parkinsonian type symptoms and even ALS type symptoms. We have seen some studies that find correlation between these chronic traumatic injuries, these subconcussive and concussive injuries, and those types of outcomes.
Yeah, Muhammad Ali.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. Muhammad Ali had Parkinson's. I have a friend who I might have mentioned on the show. I say friend, we're kind of online friends, named Steve Gleason, who has ALS. It's hard to say whether or not it was linked to his time spent playing for New Orleans or not, but we've seen a couple incidences there more recently in the news. And so I really recommend, if you want to learn more about CTE and about kind of some of the politics about the NFL, what the NFL is doing about it, how they've been really resistant to this previously, but it's becoming harder and harder to ignore, I highly recommend that you check out a Frontline episode on PBS about CTE. It's, I'm looking up exactly what it's, oh, it's called League of Denial, the NFL's Concussion Crisis. And it's a little older now. It's from 2013, but it's based on an incredible book by two really hardworking investigative journalists. The book is also called League of Denial, The NFL Concussions and the Battle for Truth. And it's by Mark Finerruwada and Steve Finerruwada. They're brothers. So that gives you a little bit of the science. It does do a really good job of going into the science and a little bit of kind of the social and political angles around it. But this recent article, you can read it. It's public access if you go to the JAMA Network and you look up Clinicopathological Evaluation of Chronic Traumatic Encephalopathy in Players of American Football. It's a great survey of a lot of the findings that they found within the brain bank recently.
It's a tough story.
Situation. Yeah. And it's obviously changing the way that a lot of people think about football. Even the NFL has been started. I mean, they have their problems. Don't get me wrong. I'm not going to dive straight into that. You can make your own decisions about that. But they have even started to make recommendations about youth football that are very, very different. And that's the thing I think that is not that it's not completely shocking that almost every brain they've looked at from an NFL player had signs of CTE, but that when they were looking at the brains of non-professional players, that high school players had mild cases of CTE, that college and professional players showed more severe effects, that it does seem to worsen with increased exposure and throughout the lifespan. And oftentimes these symptoms don't show up until later in life. So even if your child who's playing football and is playing contact football right now is having these subconcussive injuries, even if they've never been pulled off the field for a concussion, they still could be at risk. And that's why this is such an important finding. And it's really important that we keep looking into this. So I highly recommend, I think these researchers also recommend, and even the NFL now is recommending, that young people, when they play these types of contact sports, move away from the contact portion. That if you do want to play football as a child, that you play flag football and that you make it a non-contact game. Because again, your head doesn't have to hit something for you to get these types of injuries.
Yeah. It's often the whiplash.
Yeah, you know? It's like whiplash.
Along those lines, what about more common activities? How about like roller coasters? They can be pretty rough. Could that cause something like this?
I don't know if there's any research on that yet. I do think roller coasters are designed to be relatively smooth, at least the newer roller coasters, to be relatively smooth. So there's less jerky activity, because that's really an important thing. If your body goes in one direction and then it goes the other direction very quickly, that's when your brain can bounce around. So either you're accelerating and then you stop, or you suddenly decelerate, or you switch. But if it's a smooth rotation, your body can withstand quite a few G's and it doesn't really have an effect. I think the important thing to remember, though, is that these subconcussive, as they call them, injuries can occur even without you really seeing the outcome. So like a lot of young people are at risk from, let's say in soccer, from heading the ball over and over again, something that's not, that we don't think of as being that severe. And Bob, you're right. Like certain types of sports and certain types of other activities where you're having physical contact, but it's not contact with your brain, could be at risk. They likened it in this article, and I'm not sure if it's 100% accurate, but some of these kind of subconcussive injuries where they're bodies are slamming into each other and their brains are bouncing back in their skulls and they're getting some of these like sheer force injuries and things like that.
I listen to sports talk radio, among other radio shows, and I can tell you that from what I've heard, the conversation of the hosts and the guests, and they talk about this, is that the NFL will eventually have to, they think, close shop because of this.
Wow.
It will take time. It will take time. It's not going away overnight because there's a lot of powerful forces, you know, obviously, and a lot of money wanting to keep it going. But it has seen the end of the tunnel can be seen as far as it, the NFL is a professional league.
Yeah, there.
And that's what they're saying.
There are a lot of considerations there, simply because the sport itself, part of the appeal is the contact aspect of the sport. So, like, moving too far away from that core may make it so that it's not as popular, and that could be problematic right. when faced with that crossroads. And also, the amount of money that the NFL may eventually have to dish out to these individuals, you know, if these class action lawsuits continue, if the summary judgments get to be bigger and bigger, and, you know, there's more, because right now a lot of people are suffering and they're not really taken yeah. care of. And so if it gets to the point where really all of the medical bills involved would have to be paid by the NFL, I mean, that right there could, I don't know if it could bankrupt them, but it could cause a dent for sure.
It will die of, they predict it will die of attrition because enough people will stop at a very young age taking up the sport. They'll take up other sports. There's so many other things for kids to do as far as group activities and other sports and other things, that it will diminish, and eventually you're just not going to have the same population of players, and eventually that will be the swan song. That'll be the end.
I wonder how far can technology take us in protecting heads. I mean, you know,
yeah,
can,
they're trying,
right? I mean, think about it. I can conceive of a helmet that that could attenuate, you know, the vast,
I mean,
a
yes,
good chunk. But
the thing is, I understand what you're saying, Bobby, that's helmet technology has actually advanced quite a bit. But I think the problem here is that it's not just direct contact with the head. It's just the forces involved, even if it's just body on body. You know what I mean? It's the whiplash type of forces. You can't change the laws of physics inside the skull. You
yeah.
know what I mean?
Yeah, you that's can't the inject, you know, yeah. thicker liquid.
Well, not currently, anyway. All right, so Jay, how come it still takes me 6 hours to fly from New York to L.A.? Where is my supersonic jet?
Hey, what the hell?
I know, right? I find I often ask myself this question out of anger, usually when I'm at the airport, right? You're like, exactly. What the hell is going on with those supersonic yeah. jets? You know, right. Like, what the hell is this? So have any of you ever flown on one? I never even saw one in person.
No.
I've seen them at the airport back in the day, the Concorde. I've never flown on one. Yeah.
Nope.
I don't think I saw one. I mean, the coolest thing I ever saw, I did see one of the space shuttles near Kennedy Airport when they were
That's
decommissioning
right.
them.
Yes, we did see that.
Yeah.
That
I think I was going to my honeymoon with my wife, and I saw oh, my God, what a sight. It was amazing. But no, I've never seen – I don't think I've seen a supersonic plane. I've never talked to anyone that flew on one. I'm curious to know especially what it was like when the plane passed through the sound barrier. I wonder if, you know, they feel anything or whatever. So yeah, so this was the Concorde jet that was a commercial supersonic jet, and it ended its service in 2003. It flew at a top speed of 1,354 miles per
wow.
hour. That is roughly two times the speed of sound, or Mach 2 for those of you who are cool. I used to remember when I was a kid talking to my friends about, like, this fighter jet can go Mach 2, this one could go Mach 3, and we thought that the terminology, like, Mach was really fun and cool, you know, when we were young.
Yeah, because Speed Racer drove the Mach 5, I mean, right?
Hell yeah. Yeah.
That's right.
I used to play a Nintendo game called Mach Rider. I think that's what it was called.
Oh, there
it was
were
a motorcycle.
There were video arcade games called Mach This, Mach That.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's a cool name. Anyway.
So the question is, what the hell, why don't we have a supersonic plane today? That's what's
yeah.
doing
it.
Commercial.
Sound,
right.
Commercial. Yes. Commercial. Sonic boom regulations. Isn't that the bottom
line?
Well,
that's what I always thought.
Yeah, it's a little more complicated than that. So after all the amazing things that we have since 2003, like we have the epic rise of the internet, cell phone technology, we have solar cells, electric cars, driverless cars, reusable rocket technology, Bob's self-penetrating dildo. Why hasn't a company
Whoa.
Come up?
Is that a brand name?
Why hasn't a company come up with a jet that can fly faster than the Concorde? It takes about 6 hours to fly from New York City to Los Angeles in a traditional commercial aircraft. A supersonic jet could cut that down to more than half the time. I mean, I think some of the fastest estimates are about 2 hours versus 6 hours.
Whoa.
Now, that's a massive, massive time difference. But there are real and significant problems.
You could get there earlier than when you took off.
That's right. Yeah. You'd be 3 hour times.
How awesome would that be?
Well, how long would it take to go from New York to Sydney? That would be incredible.
Yeah, right. So one big problem is that when a vehicle breaks the speed of sound, it creates a sonic boom. And this is a very loud shock wave of sound. And this sound you hear when it's the sound that you hear when lightning strikes. Mm. You know, that's a lightning clap. That is that rolling massive wall of sound. If you ever looked at a real-time map of all of the commercial jets flying over pretty much everywhere in the world, you would be hearing sonic booms happening all the time. If you think about it, right? Like, look at one of those maps. You're seeing thousands of jets in the air. Now, there's questions. I don't, you know, now that I think about sonic booms, Steve, you might know, anybody else, guys. Do you hear a sonic boom only when the jet breaks the barrier, or do you hear the sonic boom when something going supersonic flies near you?
No, just when it breaks through the barrier.
So NASA has been working on concepts for viable supersonic flight, and they even gave Lockheed Martin a contract to develop a way to reduce the sonic intensity of a plane breaking the sound barrier. Oh my God, really? That is cool. Like, some engineer out there is trying to come up with a way to reduce the amount of the sonic boom, the intensity of a sonic boom when a plane breaks the sound barrier. That is freaking awesome. So this is why the Concorde was only allowed to obtain supersonic flight over the ocean, because they don't want it being disruptive to people living all over the place. And in fact, it's illegal in the United States, and I think in many other countries, for planes to break the sound barrier over the ground. Now, also, a plane has to be designed to be able to withstand the stress of flying at such high speeds, right? So it's not just the fact that it's going to break the speed of sound, but you know, when you get a vehicle up to that airspeed, and you think about the amount of pressure that's on it, on all the little components and everything that's in it, as you say, yes, we want this plane to fly faster than the speed of sound, and maybe even getting up to very high barriers above the speed of sound, the plane has to become that much more strong, and that just takes a lot of technology that today, I'm sure we have technology that can do it, but it's really expensive, and no one has produced a plane that can meet the requirements yet. Another hugely significant issue is that supersonic flight has a real cost efficiency problem. So in today's commercial jets, the airlines have figured out the most efficient speed to fly for fuel efficiency. And this is actually the speed that the planes are flying at. Now, the planes actually can fly a lot faster than they do when you – I didn't know this, but they're not flying at top speed. No, it might be close, but they're not flying at their typically at their top speed. That's because of fuel efficiency. The airlines tell the pilots, you will fly the planes at these speeds. That's it. The fuel efficiency is one of the reasons why commercial tickets have actually dropped in price significantly over the past 20 years. Anyone who travels, you know, everybody knows, they cram you in like sardines, you know, pretty much. They charge you for everything except using the bathroom at this point. It's pretty cool to know that as the jet increases its speed, the air resistance increases, and of course that increases the amount of fuel that needs to be used to keep the jet flying at that faster speed. So drag is approximately proportional to the square of velocity. So this means that even a small increase in speed could require a significant amount more fuel. So
it's actually a lot more complicated than that. It's going to be hard for us to give like the real detailed mathematical equations. So if you really want to delve into this, you know, you'll find that everything that we're saying is a gross oversimplification. But the bottom line is, because it really has to do with lift and, you know, the shape of the wings, and there's a lot of variables.
Altitude as well.
Altitude, absolutely. And there's also something Jay called critical velocity. So
yeah, critical velocity.
Yeah, when planes get close to the speed of sound, the air could break the sound barrier around parts of the plane, you know, so it's because it takes, you know, different paths to get around the plane. So, but anyway, the bottom line is that you could, you know, dramatically increase fuel use as you try to push closer and closer to the speed of sound. So most commercial
jets. I can give an example, Steve. So if you increase a plane's velocity by 10%, it requires 21% more energy. But speeding up to, by 40% nearly doubles the fuel consumption needed. So, you know, you could see a clear break where the fuel efficiency like goes crazy. I mean, yeah, in a bad direction. It gets less and less and less efficient. So today's commercial jets fly between Mach 0.78 and Mach 0.82. Now, these numbers are slightly debated, but these are close enough. Like we're saying, everything here, we're giving some round numbers here so you guys can understand what's going on. But think about it. The airlines have figured out mathematically where they want the planes to fly so they can essentially make as much profit as they can. And I don't blame them. You know, they're doing everything that they can to make flying more affordable and for them to maximize their profits as well.
Yeah, there's also an air traffic control element in here as well. Sometimes you have to slow down further just to get into your slot. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of things. It's not like you can just fly as fast as you can, you know, to get to your destination. You have to be, you know, there's a cruising velocity and then you have to get slow down to get into your to the slot to land at the airport, etc. So just throwing a faster plane in there would be problematic. There's lots of reasons why the planes aren't just getting incrementally faster. They're basically blocked into the speed that they're going.
Yeah, you could bet your ass that they have people that sit there number crunch and are really just figuring out like, okay, so in this airport and planes are going to this airport and how are we going to load balance and all that stuff.
So the reason we haven't seen increases in so long is because we reached peak efficiency a long time ago.
Yeah, basically.
Okay.
Yeah, but Evan, very important. Today's jets are much safer and more reliable than those.
Oh, safer, sure. I would.
Yeah, 20, 30, 40. Yeah, they're more fuel efficient. The engines are a lot stronger. The aeronautics, you know, all the instrumentation and everything is vastly superior today.
Yep. Each seat has its own video monitor.
Well, not actually. They stopped doing that because everyone has their own personal devices now.
Yeah, some planes have them.
I've still seen them in some.
Yeah, some
still
do.
It's still fun to play trivia games with the guy 10 seats in front of you.
That's true.
But I mean, come on. Like, you got to give it to the airlines. Like, I mean, the engines are – I saw an amazing documentary about Rolls-Royce jet engines, like the history of the company and how they did it. But like, they get into like the modern techniques that they have and how cutting edge everything is and how like ridiculously tested these engines are. You know, jet engine is this like ridiculously complicated machine, but the technology is so much on the rise. I mean, they do so much to innovate and make the engines better at everything that they do. So the reliability as well. I mean, they were making engines do crazy things in the testing facility, you know, throwing icy water through them, like, you know, thousands of gallons of water and, you know, just seeing what would it take to break the engine. Can the engine handle hitting a bird? You know, well, how much material can we throw through the engine? And they get to the point where they know the tolerances of these engines and how rugged they are. So that's fantastic because it really is safer to fly today than ever in lots of different ways. I mean, even with air traffic control, I mean, those systems have been greatly increased as well. Of course, there's details that we as non-aviation professionals, you know, we don't know. I did a lot of fun research on this, but man, we would love to hear it. If you know some details about this, guys, about breaking the sound barrier and things like what NASA is working on, please let us know because we would love to talk more about it. Conclusion, very unlikely, guys, that any of us are ever going to be on any kind of supersonic jet. I'm sad to say because I always did think that, it's just, you know, it's a technology thing, but it's not that. It's economics. The economic feasibility here is really the big problem.
Yeah, I think that for sucks. Most commercial flights, you know, the 0.75 to 0.85 or whatever range, we're pretty much going to be stuck with that. And also, there's just little incentive to make incremental improvements in speed because most of the of your travel time is not the flight time for most flights. Only for the longest flights does the flight time become significant. And actually, some airlines have actually discontinued some of their longest flights because that also is the length of the flight adds inefficiency because then you have to carry more fuel. And then you're paying mainly to fly the fuel around. So it's easier to take two shorter legs than one really, really super long leg.
Steve, what do you think about the suborbital approach, right? So I was reading some people were making some interesting points that, as an example, if you were going to fly an airplane from, say, Los Angeles to Australia, that you do a suborbital if they had a plane that could do it. That,
the parabolic ones where you go up and then come back down somewhere else?
Yeah. So from a cost perspective, the amount of pushing that you have to do to get the airplane through the air to go all the way to Australia from Los Angeles versus the amount of pushing you would have to do to get the airplane to get up to an extraordinarily high altitude is relatively the same.
Yeah, it's about the same.
Yeah, and I thought that was really interesting because, you know, instead of going straight across, going up and coming down, you know, could dramatically decrease the travel time, from what I understand. I mean,
yeah, it's possible. It's possible. I think, so supersonic flights could have a niche for really long flights, New York to Tokyo, that kind of thing, New York to London, for, you know, transcontinental, basically, flights where taking 3 hours instead of 15 hours, you know, would be nice. Oh, yeah. Especially, but that's probably going to appeal to wealthy businessmen, things like that. But, you know, the Concorde really stopped flying because it wasn't commercially viable. It cost too much.
Yeah,
the market was too little. It really was a loss. It was more for the prestige for the airline. You know, it really wasn't itself making any money. So the question that I have, and it seems like it's certainly not a no-brainer, is will supersonic flight, even though it's technologically possible now, obviously we had one already, or even if they reduce the sonic boom and they get the cost down in half or whatever, will it really ever get to economic feasibility, or is it always going to be just a novelty, you know?
Yeah, I hear you. I know.
Even if like we've gone to Australia a couple of times, would you spend $5,000, $6,000, $10,000 to get from New York to Sydney?
Me? I couldn't even if I wanted to, but I hear what you're saying, Steve. It costs
almost that much just to go there now, like $5,000 to go there.
Yeah, would you spend twice as much, $10,000, to get there in half the time?
Yeah, you're right. It's the people. No. It's the people who would already be buying first class tickets or business class tickets. Yeah,
yeah, but I would spend a little bit more to have a better experience on the plane.
I pay more for legroom on long flights. That's worth it. All right, Bob, tell us about this breakthrough that might lead to soft engines. What's this about?
Yeah, so scientists have found a variation of the Leidenfrost effect, which it's called the elastic Leidenfrost effect, which causes hydrogel balls to bounce and shriek on a hot plate and may one day allow for the creation of what's called these soft engines. So now to experience a Leidenfrost or Leidenfrost, apparently, to experience this effect, many of us have seen it, probably almost all, maybe, drop some water on a hot frying pan and you'll see the drops kind of skittering around. If you don't pay too much of attention, you know, you may not think too much about it. But one thing you should notice is that they're lasting, you know, they're hanging around for a long time. They really should be disappearing a lot sooner than they do. And you may have wondered why. Well, this is because the evaporating layer of water touching the hot plate, the vapor actually insulates the water droplet above it and it protects it from the intense heat below and therefore extending its life. So that's kind of what you're seeing. It's kind of floating on the hot plate, not really touching it, kind of resting on this vapor layer that slowly, you know, eats away at the water droplet much faster than if that layer wasn't there. Now, so most skeptics though are familiar with the Leidenfrost effect in conjunction with firewalking.
Yeah.
Right. So now most of the protection of firewalkers have are due really to the low heat capacity and the heat transfer rate of the wood embers and even then the ash on top of it. So it's basically the wood can't hold a lot of heat and it can't transfer a lot of heat to your skin very quickly. That's the bottom line. That's what's saving your feet. But you can get another measure of protection by walking over the embers with sweaty or wet feet. And in that case, the Leidenfrost effect insulates your feet from some of that heat and it will make it a more pleasant experience. So now the new effect is similar, but has some very interesting differences. So this was discovered by physicist Scott Wadukaitis. He stumbled upon a YouTube video that was posted by a Ukrainian programmer. He showed hydrogel balls on a frying pan. Now, each hydrogel ball is basically water saturated polyacrylamide gel. And now these are used in diapers, contact lenses, and even those floral beads that people can use to water plants since they're like 98% water and you could slowly have the water release and water your plants if you're going away for a long weekend or whatever. So in the video though, they were not floating. These balls, these little squishy balls, they were not floating on vapor. like the plain water droplets were, that they were vigorously bouncing around and letting out some noise. And I will play that noise right now. So that's the noise that they make. And so when Scott heard this on the video, he said he had a really funny quote. He's like, they come to life essentially and scream, which is basically what happens. You throw them on the pan, they start bouncing and they start screaming in a way. Not quite like screaming, more like chittering. But it's a cool little sound. And Jay, I'm sorry, but you could have totally used that for your Who's That Noisy, but too late now. So now scientists know about the Leidenfrost effect. They've known about them for a really long time, but they knew about it when dealing with liquids and solids, solids that could sublimate. But they didn't know anything about substances between those two extremes, the soft solids. They really didn't know anything about it. So Scott, Scott was a physicist and into material, like soft material science, I believe. He was so intrigued, he decided to write a grant proposal to explore what was happening, which is awesome because he just happened to see a video and was like, oh, wow, that's really cool. I wonder what's really going on. I'll write a grant proposal. So this led to the discovery by Scott and his team at the University of Leiden. Oh, wow. What a name for what a coincidence. So they found an unknown effect. This has never been documented before, and it's called the elastic Leidenfrost effect, which I will call ELFI. So this is what he discovered. So the hot plate vaporizes a small amount of water, and this released vapor interacts with the squishy ball, causing it to change its internal pressure and to deform very rapidly over and over and over. And this movement transfers energy to the ball, causing it to bounce. And these oscillations are quite fast, about 3,000 hertz or cycles per second. And that's what's causing the high-pitched sounds. So he had to use high-speed photography or video cameras to actually see this. I saw some of that video, and it's really, really cool. So it's a really cool phenomenon. And I know there's some people out there thinking, okay, so what? What can this do beyond being a cool party trick trying to make these balls scream? But actually, this does have some interesting potentials. The Energy Harvesting Journal claims these findings suggest a new strategy for injecting mechanical energy into a widely used class of soft materials with potential relevance in fields such as active matter, soft robotics, and microfluidics. So it does potentially have many applications. So for soft robotics, the idea is that you can maybe use these hydrogels or a hydrogel-like substance as an engine, actually as an engine. And if you think about it, all the major components of the engine are already there. In one ball of hydrogel, you have the fuel, right? The water. You have this piston mechanism. Is it the heated ball kind of like fluxes up and down or whatever. It deforms and bounces. You have mechanical output all in this one little hydrogel ball. It's essentially a little engine. And because the squishiness factor is critical, they're calling it a soft engine, basically. And so the Scott, I think, was imagining things like running wires through this soft hydrogel type robot and basically heating it where you need the movement, where the movement might be required. So this could have some very interesting downstream, effects, with robotics, with active matter, which is another area that's fascinating, and microfluidics. So who knows what we're going to see from this. And even if, none of that even pans out, you could always throw these balls in a frying pan and hear them scream.
Yeah, it's one of those things. I think that, do you think they're struggling to say like what would be the practical application of this? Do you think it's actually viable that you could use this?
Yeah, it really. At first, I was thinking along the lines of like, oh, very cool, but not really thinking you can go anywhere with it. But the idea that these are little engines and all you need is heat. Converting heat into mechanical energy. Hey, that's something that's very broad. Yeah. Something that you could apply to, like I said, these lots of different areas.
Interesting. All right, just a quick one on measles. There was a recent article published in JAMA Pediatrics. So we know that measles is a highly infectious disease, right? It's one of the most infectious diseases, in fact. The measles virus can survive for up to a couple of hours on surfaces, like so if you sneeze or something, those viruses can infect somebody up to 2 hours later, just sitting on the counter or wall. You can get it onto your hands by rubbing your eyes or your nose. So for that, it's considered an extremely infectious, you know, contagious illness. But as you know, there is a vaccine for it, the MMR vaccine. One of those M's is for measles, mumps, measles, and rubella. And that has dramatically reduced the incidence of measles in countries with a vaccine program. But measles is starting to come back because of what's so-called vaccine hesitancy. You know, parents who are hesitant to vaccinate their kids because of the fears that are spreading through social media and otherwise. And we know that when vaccine levels drop, measles is coming back pretty dramatically. So this is just a study just looking, trying to do some calculations like computer modeling to say, all right, if we had a small drop in the vaccine rate for measles, what would that actually do to the number of cases? And what they found is that even a 5% reduction in measles vaccine would result in a threefold increase in annual measles cases, which is still only would put it like from 50 to 150, but still that would cost $2.1 million, those extra cases. So that would pay for a lot of vaccines, of course. Now that's only counting kids age 2 to 11. So if you include younger children and adults, you know, teens and adults, the cost would be a lot higher and the number of cases would be much higher. This also doesn't consider the effects of pockets of vaccine hesitancy or vaccine refusal. So even if you look at if the that 5% decrease were sort of spread everywhere, the effect wouldn't be as dramatic as if you have communities where you have concentrated vaccine refusal. And we know that's the case. For example, there was a survey in California finding that some, you know, county by county, and some counties had vaccine rates for measles as low as 70%. Yeah. So herd immunity is about 90%, you know, is where you need to be to get herd immunity. 95 is better. When it gets below 90%, then you really start to lose herd immunity. And it that's herd immunity basically means that most people are vaccinated so that the virus doesn't have a chance to spread. So it reduces the risk of an outbreak. But in addition, if vaccine rates get low enough, so one thing that happens is you lose herd immunity and you can have outbreaks. But the other risk is that measles could go back to being an endemic illness. Do you guys know what that means, endemic?
Yeah, native to a specific location.
Yeah, so.
But there's a difference between endemic and native, right?
Well, it means that the infection is self-sustaining.
Yeah.
Within the broader population. So that's
like there's enough of a reservoir that it's passed around.
Yeah. So it's constantly being passed around and never going away entirely. And measles was endemic in the U.S., you know, for a long time. And it wasn't until vaccine rates got very high, you know, sometime in the 1990s that measles ceased to become endemic. And then we only get outbreaks when measles is introduced from the outside. You know, somebody brings measles in from another country. But there are no native cases that are keeping it going. But if vaccine rates get low enough, measles could go back to becoming endemic. And then, of course, that's a dramatic increase in the number of cases because it's not just, you know, vulnerable to outbreaks when measles is introduced by foreign travel, but it's just constantly moving around the population. You know, we can go back to there being thousands of cases again. France basically had that problem. France is having like thousands of cases of measles. Anyway, this is your public service reminder that, you know, this is the thing that we've been warning against for years, that, the anti-vaccine movement, the spreading unwarranted fears, unfounded fears about vaccines, reducing vaccination rates is going to result in some of these infectious diseases coming back, maybe even becoming endemic again. And now we're seeing it. And measles is like the canary in the coal mine. That's the first one because that's the most contagious, or one of the most contagious. So that's I think that's why we're seeing so many measles cases, especially in vulnerable populations. And that's just going to continue to get worse. And again, even small, with this new piece of information is confirming that even small drops in the vaccination rate can result in dramatic increases in the number of cases, and we're not even talking about getting to that tipping point of it going back to being endemic, which is certainly a possibility. So we need to keep pushing. You know, we need to keep pushing back against anti-vaccine, you know, fear, misinformation, and propaganda, and make sure that people understand that these diseases are real and they're not benign. Measles is not a benign disease. It can cause severe neurological injury, hospitalization, death, and statistically small, but that still could be a lot of cases if the number of cases of measles goes up. So this is a fight that we have to keep on fighting.
It's just unnecessary otherwise. I mean, why? There's no good argument to not vaccinate.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, there's a percentage of the population that are medically can't vaccinate, but
well, sure. That's what
they depend on exception. The herd immunity.
Yep.
Yeah, they depend on herd immunity. Yeah. All right, Evan, what's this Moon Express? Tell us about that.
Yeah, it's a private spaceflight company called Moon Express. And for some time now, actually, they've been promising to mine the moon, send some equipment up to the moon and mine it for its goodies and bring it on back to Earth. That's their big promise. They've announced, finally, their plan to get started. So it's been a plan of secrecy for many years, but they finally just recently revealed the scope of their ambitions. And ultimately, the company wants to set up a robotic lunar outpost on the moon's south pole by 2020. Not far off.
That sounds very ambitious.
Very ambitious. Yeah.
Very. What year is it right now?
I know. Yeah. We're more than halfway through 2017. So, you know, time's ticking away here. The concept relies on their new fleet of robotic landers that they want to build called the MX Robotic Explorers. A single modular spacecraft, which they are calling the MX-1E, it is similar in size and shape to R2-D2 from Star Wars, but a little bit bigger. What's actually really neat about this particular craft is that it can be combined with other MX-1Es to form successfully larger and more capable vehicles. So it has this sort of Voltron feel to it, right? Yeah. Picture a bunch of astromech droids like R2-D2 combining into Megadroid or something like that. I think it's a very cool concept and a neat idea. All of their spacecraft from Moon Express, they're powered by a new, what they're calling, eco-friendly engine called the PECO, P-E-C-O. Now, the PECO engine operates on highly refined kerosene and hydrogen peroxide. That's interesting.
Well, actually, yeah, hydrogen peroxide, you're reacting to the hydrogen peroxide.
That's the source of oxygen.
Yeah, right. They're pulling the oxygen from there. That makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of jetpacks use that, right?
I haven't bought any jetpacks lately, but I imagine that's true.
Yeah. Trust me. I've read that in conjunction with lots of jetpacks.
I mean, but when you see that the ingredients here are kerosene and hydrogen peroxide, I'm thinking, like, I can go to Walmart and pick these things
Absolutely.
And what's also neat about these vehicles, they're flexible in purpose. So they can be used as landers to put payloads on the moon, or used as orbiters to travel around the moon and support missions and do other things like that. So other configurations will combine 2 of them, 5 of them, and as many as 9 of them to perform increasingly capable missions to the moon and possibly deeper into the solar system, such as the moons of Mars. Or who knows, maybe Mars itself. The various configurations of the MX spacecraft are sized to fit within different launchers. For example, if you have one of these MX-1Es, it will fit within Rocket Lab's Slim Electron vehicle. If you have the configuration that has 2 of these, it could fit within Virgin Galactic's Launcher 1 rocket. And if you have the big one, the MX-9, you could fit that into the Falcon 9. So it's neat. So they're designed to already fit with existing rocket technology. In the case of the MX-9, and there are video, well, there's graphics of it online. You can see simulations on YouTube if you look up MX-9. It's equipped for sample return. In other words, they're going to put 9 of these things together, land it onto the moon, and then they're going to carry one of these MX-1s to the moon's surface with it. What they'll do is they'll load the payload into that MX-1 that they brought in, and it will launch, and then it will launch itself back to the Earth.
Yeah, okay, because you don't need as much fuel to launch off the moon as you do the Earth.
Not nearly. And this will, certainly add to our very, very limited stores of moon rocks and moon dust and these particles that we have, which are extremely coveted, extremely valuable, And they want to make it so that, you know, one day it becomes, you know, hey, even Bob, you can own a piece of moon rock or some moon dust, which would be really neat.
What makes you think I don't already?
Because it's illegal. Apparently, NASA brought back 842 pounds of lunar material, but they haven't sold any of it. They, you know, keeping it all to themselves. So I think it remains to be seen, though, what the act. I mean, I think there's definitely going to be a market for it, and they'll make a lot out of it, but it's hard to say exactly how much, because of course the more they bring back, the less valuable it's going to be.
Plus I wonder
how much of, like, say they talk about, oh, this speck of lunar dust sold for $400,000, but I wonder if the association with the Apollo mission is
has
part
a value
of that price. Mm-hmm. Yeah, is not just the fact that it's a moon rock, but we'll see. I hope that it becomes a viable business model for them. Yeah. That'd be interesting.
There are two problems right now that they're experiencing. The first problem is that the Electron, the vehicle for the single spacecraft, the rocket that they want to send it up on, it's flown once during a test flight and it didn't quite make it into orbit. Oops. So they haven't quite gotten that worked out yet, but there are going to be two more test launches coming up in the coming months. And they think they figured out the reason why it didn't make it to orbit, although they didn't explain it in detail. They're hoping they have that fixed. And then the second thing is, Moon Express has not shown or revealed its lander's hardware. Again, it's this very secretive thing that they're just sort of now starting to reveal. So we don't know that, you know, the thing is really, you know, working the way at least that they're claiming it works. So we're going to be seeing it, though, they say later this year. They are going to try to grab the Google Lunar X Prize, which is a competition to send the first privately funded vehicle to the moon. And if they can do it by the end of 2017, which is a long, long, long shot, they will win $20 million. If they can make it there and they can have the vehicle do a few things on the moon that it's required to do. Very long shot, but they said that they are trying.
Aiming for that.
They're aiming for it.
Thank you, Evan. All right, Kara, what's the word?
The word this week is a fun one. It was actually recommended by Jenny Navis from Portland, Oregon. She learned about parsimony, which is the word, in her biology 101 class. And she says her professor's use of the principle helped her to understand why birds really are dinosaurs. So let's dive into it. The first definition, both in Merriam-Webster and Oxford, is the quality of being careful with or having extreme unwillingness to spend money or resources, or being stingy. So that is not the definition that we will be diving deeply into here in this segment, but it is the first definition, and it is appropriate to use it as such. The second definition is a little more relevant to our interests, and it has to do with what's sometimes called the scientific law of parsimony, which states that things are usually connected or behave in the most economic way possible or use the fewest assumptions, especially when describing things like evolutionary lineages. Now, Steve, I know that you've talked about this in the past on the show, and definitely you put it into our upcoming book where you talked about how the idea of parsimony relates to but isn't the exact same as Occam's razor. Isn't that right?
Well, yeah, I mean, just a discussion of what the best interpretation of Occam's razor is. Mm-hmm. Actually, I think that parsimony is closer to what it is. The misinterpretation of Occam's razor is that the simplest answer is the one that's most likely to be true.
That's how it's portrayed. Yeah, that's in not shows and yeah. TV.
That's not quite right. It's the most parsimonious answer, and what is specifically meant by that is the one that introduces the fewest new assumptions.
Yeah.
So, absolutely. To give you an example, if you say, "Well, what are the causes of, for example, alien implants and animal mutilations and crop circles and photographs of alleged UFOs," I would have a separate explanation for all of those phenomena, whereas a UFO believer might say, no, they're all caused by aliens. That's the simpler explanation. Therefore, Occam's razor favors it. But in actuality, I'm coming up with prosaic explanations for each of them that does not require any major new assumptions, whereas aliens visiting the Earth is a massive new assumption, and therefore parsimony favors the more complicated answer that doesn't introduce new assumptions. That's the critical difference.
So in that way, actually, you are utilizing Occam's razor because it's more parsimonious, not because it's more simple.
Yes, exactly.
I love it. All right. So parsimony actually comes from the 15th century Latin parsimonia. People say I butcher French all the time, but I think Latin's close to Spanish, so I doubt that's anything other than parsimonia. The prefix pars means to spare, to refrain from, or to save, while monia is a suffix that we see in a lot of words indicating a condition or an action. So really, parsimony directly translates to the state of saving or using moderately, which makes sense both in the terms of being stingy, being careful with or having unwillingness to use money or resources, but also in the sense of limited assumptions or, you know, being economical in your thinking or your approaches to these kinds of problems. So you can see how parsimony in the sciences and in philosophy is related to the earlier definition having to do with finances, because it comes from similar roots.
Pretty word.
Mm-hmm. It is a pretty word.
So, Steve, before we move on, I want to thank one of our listeners and his wife. This is Keith Davies and Maya Davies. These two guys were crazy generous to the SGU. So just, you know, on a lark, he sent us an email and I wrote him back, and he's a woodworker. And it looks like, from the pictures that he sent, I'm like, wow, this guy does some really quality work. And I just pinged him, like, just lightly going, hey, you know, you have any interest in building a wood prop for the SGU set? And he got super excited and he ended up...
Awesome.
Right, Bob? This blew my mind. He ended up building a engineering thing that hangs on the wall in Star Trek, the original series. You would see it in the hallway on the Enterprise. And he copied a picture of one of the original props that I gave him exactly and hand-built it out of wood, like perfect, like I couldn't imagine it getting done better than this because he's a woodworker.
Yeah, you were saying it's probably awesome. Better than the prop that was actually on the set.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah, it's most definitely mache, because it's, you know, he made it out of oak. I mean, this is a hard, solid piece. He was asking me what's the relative humidity in Connecticut just to make sure that he's going to be able to build, you know, with the right kind of wood that can handle the humidity, the whole deal. He's mounting it for me. He's sending it to me mounted. So I can put it together and glue it and do everything. He's sending me the drill bits I need and the screws that I need. And then his wife decides to buy the primer, so they primed it for me. Aww. I mean, they did everything but hand deliver it from Denver to Connecticut.
That's so sweet.
So Keith, my God, thank you. And thank you for giving me a distraction during the worst week of my life to know I had something to talk about that wasn't about my dad that really made me happy and gave me something to look forward to at a dark time. Thank you, and thank your wife, Maya, so much. I can't wait, and I will be, like, talking about it when we do the next SGU Live on Facebook. I'm going to walk over to it, and we're going to talk about it. Okay?
Yeah, absolutely.
It's awesome.
Yeah, I can't wait. Definitely.
Yeah, Jay was literally showing me pictures of it on his phone during the wake. Which was a very needed distraction.
It was. I know everybody needed to think about something else.
All right, well, I'll make you all feel better. Let's go on with science or fiction.
Hey.
All right.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fake, and I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. You guys ready? Just three regular items this week.
Mm-hmm.
Item number one, a new study finds that humans are able to identify emotions from the vocalizations of all air-breathing vertebrates. Item number two, researchers have genetically modified human skin cells to make them 100 times more resistant to damage from UV light without a change in pigment. And item number three, a new review of studies finds that sperm count has decreased by 50% in Western males in the last 40 years. All right, Jay, go first.
All right, let's do this. This one here, it says that the new study finds that humans are able to identify emotions from the vocalization of all air-breathing vertebrates. All air-breathing vertebrates. So humans are able to identify emotion. All right, so...
like amphibians, reptiles, mammals, birds.
So so you're saying that we can understand or interpret emotion from anything that breathes air, that's a vertebrate.
That's what
you're saying?
That's what
it says. Okay. All right, interesting. Wow. I mean, look, all right, quick anecdote. I just saw a video on YouTube where this guy like poked this little salamander that he had and it screamed. And yeah, I knew what it meant. I got it. You know, that's interesting. And I've heard my bird vocalize like crazy. And I think I understand what he or she is saying because I don't know what sex my bird is. X1 researchers have genetically modified human skin cells to make them 100 times more resistant to damage from UV light. What the hell? That's pretty damn cool. This is the kind of stuff I really want to start happening, you know, because eventually I want to become a cyborg, but this is really cool. I could see that I could see something going on there. Let me just get to the last one and then I'll let you know. A new review of studies finds that sperm count has decreased by 50% in Western males in the last 40 years. I think that one is science. I'm going to say the air-breathing vertebrates one is, that one is the fake. Thank you.
Okay, Evan.
Humans are able to identify emotions from the vocalizations of all air-breathing vertebrates. Wow, all air-breathing vertebrates. I have to think about that for a bit, but that's pretty specific when you say all, not some. In a sense, I'm inclined to think that might be a something to that, which might lead it to be the fiction. Identify emotions. That's interesting. Really interesting. The next one about the human skin cells. 100 times more resistant to damage from UV light without a change in pigment. 100 times more resistant. How? Without a change in pigment. What else? Does it have to do with thickness? Does it have to do with reflectiveness? But that would be pigment. I don't know that one. How's that going to work? I don't understand how that one could really work. And 100 times. I mean, Bob, order of magnitude?
Two
orders of magnitude. That's a lot. And then this last one, the sperm count has decreased by 50%. Wow. In Western males in the last 40 years. Why has this happened? Sperm count decreased by 50% in Western males. I had a friend, an acquaintance, I'll say, who had a theory years ago saying that they were, governments were not only putting like fluoride and things in the water, but also estrogen and things like that. He thought it was a big conspiracy to kind of make men
sap our precious bodily fluids.
Exactly, right? Yeah, essentially that's what he was saying. Or trying to, you know, just calm the savage beast that is man or the male part of humans. But geez, I have a feeling that was right. I don't know about this 100 times, two orders of magnitude. That seems way, way, way too high. I could understand maybe 10 times, something like that, but 100 times just seems out of the ballpark. I'll say that one's the fiction.
Okay, Bob.
Okay, let's see. So the vocalizations. Yeah, the all, of course, is what makes this one's a little unbelievable. I mean, a few animals I could see, but all, every damn one. But then again, it wouldn't surprise me that there's some, you know, common descent that makes it possible for some people to actually hear some emotion in the sounds. I don't know. The sperm count, yeah, I could, 50% is a lot. But I think modern clothing, I think, probably has had a hand in that, so to speak. The second one seems like an anomaly, though, with the skin cells. I don't think, but the way I'm reading this, I'm not reading this as something that they can use on people. You know, something like they took some skin cells, they genetically modified those skin cells to not be damaged by UV light much. But I'm not sure how this could be useful for people. So this one just kind of stands out. So I'm going to say that the skin cell is fiction.
And Kara.
Yeah, I think I'm going to go with consensus on this one. Sorry, Jay. Although the air-breathing vertebrates one seems like ostensibly the least unlikely, I like what you said about there being kind of common descent and you know, some sort of evolutionary consistency between distress calls and, you know, pleasureful calls or whatever sounding the same to our ears. Yeah, so I don't know. The skin cells, genetically modified skin cells, even if this had happened in the lab, it wouldn't be applicable. How do you put on new skin? Spray it all over yourself? I don't know. This one bugs me. So I'm gonna go with you guys and say that's the fiction.
Okay. So let's start with number three, since you all agree on that one. A new review of studies finds that sperm count has decreased by 50% in Western males in the last 40 years. You all think that one is science, and that one is science.
Yay!
Well, yay, but not yay.
Yeah.
Jay, now, these findings are controversial. Previous studies did not some have shown this, some haven't. This is the most thorough review to date, and they tried to account for some of the potentially confounding factors in prior research. But still, there are those who are not convinced that this is a real finding. So the studies are finding this, you know, that if you look at, you know, sperm counts from the 1950s, you know, to today, for example, the numbers are lower. But the question is, are the techniques comparable? There, some people think that they were overestimating sperm count using the older methods, you know, from 40 years ago. So that may not be representative. Another concern is that there's publication bias, that studies that show dropping sperm counts are more likely to get published than those that don't. And so if you're reviewing the literature and there's a publication bias, you're going to get a distorted result. So this review does move us in the direction of there being a concern about this, but it doesn't settle the debate. And I think we're going to need to like do some consistent prospective studies to see if this is a trend that's actually happening. If it is real, then what are the possible causes? And the study doesn't really look into that. They, you know, the reporting on this, first of all, the reporting on this, I think, you know, a lot of outlets said something like, if trends continue, then the human species can go extinct. Have you guys see that headline?
Yeah. Which it's like, no, it doesn't quite work that way. Yeah, I guess if trends continue to zero.
Yeah, if trends continue, trends never continue. I mean, that's like, yeah, exactly. It's just ridiculous. If you could take anything that's moving in any direction, and if you say, and if you extrapolate this trend indefinitely into the future, really crazy shit happens. Of course it does, because that's not the way reality works. You just can't take a current trend and extrapolate it indefinitely into the future. So, but if there has been this decline, what might be the possible causes? This also, I think, is a lot where some of the reporting focused on that. It's like that's the fact that the sperm count is decreasing was the only focus of the research. The potential reasons for it are pure speculation. But that's, you know, I think they emphasize that reporting a little too much. That speculation is the usual suspects. What are people going to say? Is it our changing diets? Is it, you know, obesity is mentioned? Is it pesticides, toxins in the environment, whatever? You know, there's anything environmental that you could think of, you could say is potentially a cause. But there's no data really for that. So there's no, that's again, that element of it was pure speculation. But, you know, it could be changes in habits. Like, you know, like things like wearing tight underwear do affect your sperm count. So something as seemingly benign as that might be playing a role. Taking more hot baths or whatever, who knows? Huh. But it could also be a result of other, you know, lifestyle or toxicity factors, but that has not been established. So for me, this is like, okay, this is a potential issue. Let's follow this going forward with reliable methodology to see if it's real. You know, this is not like, let's panic because the human species is going extinct, you know, level. But anyway, of course, some papers had to take the headline in that direction. But anyway, that one is science. So let's go back to number one. A new study finds that humans are able to identify emotions from the vocalizations of all air-breathing vertebrates. Jay, you think this one is the fiction, despite having some compelling anecdotes about it. Everyone else thinks this one is science. And this one is science. Sorry, Jay.
Yay. Oh, gosh.
Sorry, Jay.
Obviously, they didn't test every single species. They were just showing that a broad sampling of amphibians, reptiles, birds, mammals, you know, all show this effect. And therefore, you know, there's no reason to think that that's a coincidence that the species they chose to look at all show it. So it's probably universal to all air-breathing vertebrates. That was their conclusion. Obviously, you know, can't specifically, you know, technically conclude that from the data, but that was the most parsimonious conclusion.
Ah, nice.
I see what you did there.
Yeah.
Though this suggests, and the authors think that this may be the case, that the emotional, you know, expressing emotions in vocalizations may be universal to all air-breathing vertebrates, meaning that it emerged essentially in the first land vertebrates to evolve and, you know, spread throughout, you know, all land dwelling vertebrates since then, evolutionarily, including people. Now, of course, we're when you're interpreting the emotions of a frog, it's pretty simple. You know, the emotions are simple. It mainly was discerning level of agitation, excitement, activity, not so much, oh yeah, he's really, you know, brooding over his recent loss. You know, yeah, absolutely. It was just more, more straightforward type of thing. But Jay, you're right. Like, it does, like, when animals are sending up the alarm, right, in alarm, and it does make sense that that would be cross species, right? If other species are alarmed by the presence of a predator, you want to know that too, that that fright is not specific to that one species. That would be the kind of thing that anyone in the environment would want to know about, for example. So there is some sense to that. Clearly, you know, more research will illuminate this further, but so far it looks like that's pretty universal. They also, the report on this mentioned the fact that Darwin himself thought that this would be the case. He did speculate that the emotions of vocalizations is something that's likely, that we will find that it's universal to all land-dwelling vertebrates.
Way to go, Chuck.
Yeah, maybe that prediction is turning out to be true. Okay, all of this means that researchers have genetically modified human skin cells to make them 100 times more resistant to damage from UV light without a change in pigment is the fiction. I actually don't think that that's implausible, though, because all you have to do is to have the production of a protein that absorbs a lot of UV light, and that would do it. So I think that that sort of thing is extremely plausible, but I did make this up, and it didn't actually happen. What I did get it from, and I thought that
this might fool somebody,
they did develop a DNA sunscreen that apparently gets more effective the longer you wear it. Now,
Well, that's cool, but also sounds like cancer.
Well, okay, so but it's the sunscreen itself it contains DNA. It's like a DNA film, and they tested it in the lab, and they found that when you expose it to UV light, it breaks the bonds in the DNA. The DNA is absorbing the UV light, and that's how it's protective. But that as the DNA absorbed UV light, it actually got better at absorbing even more UV light. That's what they mean. It gets better over time. Now, that doesn't mean, and this is the bit I think that the reporting glossed over, is that it doesn't mean that the product itself would be more effective over time, because it could still erode away. You know what I mean? Rub off.
Yeah.
So that doesn't mean that the sunscreen itself would be more effective, just that the DNA in the sunscreen actually absorbs more UV light as it breaks down.
Well, maybe it would compensate for what's been
wearing off. Might compensate for that, or we'll see. I mean, I think that they weren't testing an actual product in real people. It was more just testing this concept, this DNA film or coating, and that they discovered that one aspect of it. They said this could have a lot of applications beyond sunscreen as well. You could use it as a see-through dressing for wounds, because it's very hygrophobic. So they said it's hygroscopic, which means that it will hold in water. So it actually is a moisturizer as well. It holds in the moisture on the skin. So it could have that double benefit, but that also could be good for wounds potentially. And so it could be like a rapid spray-on dressing that you could see through, so you could check the wound, for example.
DNA rocks.
Yeah, so interesting. they use DNA in the substance itself as a way of blocking UV light. So we'll see if that pans out as an actual product.
Whose DNA do they use?
Yeah, right.
Yikes.
I guess you could use frog DNA. I mean, it doesn't really matter. It doesn't have to be human DNA. Just the molecule itself. Could be junk DNA. Gotta do something with all that junk DNA. We'll recycle it. Make a suntan lotion out of it. But I decided not to use that one. That inspired me to just make up the fake one about genetic modification.
All right, so I lost. I got it.
You did. You did lose. Jay.
But you had some. Yeah, but I don't think your reasoning was too far off, Jay.
No, I think it was. You know,
way off.
It was wrong. Okay, Evan. Give us a quote, Evan.
This week's quote was suggested by listener Clay Cavanis from Jersey City, New Jersey. Thank you, Clay. When you discover new information or a broader context, you have to throw out the old understanding, no matter how much sense it made to you. Getting it right in the future is more important than the feeling of understanding you had it in the past. Very cool. Dr. Ben Tippett, Now, Ben Tippett is one of the hosts of the podcast called the Titanium Physicists Podcast. He himself is a theoretical physicist, PhD from the math department at University of New Brunswick. He sometimes contributes to Science Sort Of Podcast. And in his spare time, he likes to write papers about superhero psychics or zombies. So he's right up our alley. So
I like that quote. It's very insightful, and I find that that's one of the things I have difficulty with. Because it's obviously nice to feel like you understand something, you know.
That's
and
right.
Giving that up, going from, you know, something being wrapped in a nice little bow, like, okay, I think I have a whole my whole narrative here. I understand how this all works. And then when something throws a monkey wrench into it, it's hard to give up that understanding. And especially if you're giving it up for less understanding, it's like, oh my God, it's more complicated than I thought. Now I actually don't understand it. You know, so yeah. It feels like you're going backwards, and you, there is this sort of knee-jerk resistance to that. You want to hold on to that nice, neat little narrative that you have. But yeah, you absolutely have to discipline yourself to say, no, okay, screw it. That's not true. I have to surrender it. But yeah, that could be tough sometimes.
I can't call it the KT boundary anymore.
Right.
So,
or maybe it wasn't just the asteroid that killed the dinosaurs. Maybe it's more complicated than that. Mm-hmm. It might have been a double whammy.
Several factors.
It's like, crap, actually, it's controversial. We don't really know as much as we thought, as I thought we did.
But it is important. It's an important concept. And we have to, you're right, Steve, it's not innate. We have to work at it. We have to really try hard to make that adjustment.
It takes a conscious effort. You have to, it's all part of being comfortable with uncertainty. You know, and it's a big part of critical thinking and skepticism. Obviously, skepticism is about doubt, but it's just not, it is not emotionally satisfying. It causes cognitive dissonance, you know, this notion of uncertainty, whereas certainty feels comfortable. We like to check that box and say, okay, boom, this is what it is. And I know some people, it's like the feeling of understanding is just too tempting to surrender. You know, and they'll reach for something because it works, not because it's actually true or because it sort of fits into their pre-existing structure. Really, really something tempting that you have to work against. Well, Evan, thanks for that great quote.
Thank you, Steve.
And thank you all for joining me this week.
Sure,
thanks,
man.
Doc.
Thanks.
Thank you.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at theskepticsguide.org, where you will find the show notes as well as links to our blogs, videos, online forum, and other content. You can send us feedback or questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. Also, please consider supporting the SGU by visiting the store page on our website, where you will find merchandise, premium content, and subscription information. Our listeners are what make SGU possible. We'll be right back.